Coming up next on Mac Break Weekly, Leo is still out of town, so I'm hosting the show, joined as usual by our co-host, Renee Ritchie. I've got a couple of really great guests for you this week, Chris Breen of MacWorld.com, and we're also joined by Tanya Angst, Grand Poobah or Grand Poobah-S of Tidbits Publications. This week, we're going to be talking all about things like multi-touch on Mac OS. Is that a really good idea or is that a really fantastic idea? We're going to be complaining about iCloud. I'm not going to put a dull point on that. We're not really very happy with iCloud. And because of news of this week, we've been giving lots of good reasons to renew our not hatred, but not likelihood of iCloud. And then finally, we're going to talk about what would it take for us to switch away from Mac OS? Would it actually take a National Guard detachment and a certain amount of plastic explosives? I will not reveal the ending, but suffice to say that the duck is wearing a hat in the playground. I think you know what I mean. All this and more coming up next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Mac Break Weekly is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Mac Break Weekly, episode 326, recorded on November 20th, 2012. It all comes back to AC/DC.
Mac Break Weekly is brought to you by American Express Bank FSB, offering a high-yield savings account. The perfect complement to help you reach your savings goal. To learn more and open an account online, visit personalsavings.com/online savings. Member FDIC. And by Ford, featuring Available Sync. Now you can control your media player with simple voice commands. Enjoy your drive while you easily search and listen to your favorite songs. Check it out on the 2012 Ford Focus or at ford.com/technology. And by audible.com. To download the free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/MacBreak and get a copy of Brian Sanderson's Legion absolutely free at audible.com/Sanderson.
It's time once again for Mac Break Weekly, although you might want to keep a spreadsheet or something open on your desktop just in case the boss walks by. I'm Andy Notko, Chicago Sun-Times technology columnist, substituting for the, I'm assuming, very, very tanned and still lightly drunk Leo Laporte, who is enjoying some time in the lower latitudes on the Geek Cruise and probably spending time figuring out how to fix his back after all those hours on an airplane. But we got a great show lined up for you with some of the wonderful members of what I call my League of Substitute Heroes that I draw on those rare times when I get to host. But first, we have to introduce my fellow weekly host of Mac Break Weekly, Renee Ritchie from iMore. Renee, how is life up in the upper latitudes?
It is excellent, Andy. As everyone who watches Game of Thrones knows, winter has come. The wall is very tall, and I will be shivering during the show, but everything else is good.
Now, is HBO lying to us? Is like when you go into the cold climes, you basically see burly men in heavy fur coats and naked women?
We cling to your borders for warmth, so it's not quite that bad. But I think vampires should move here because we don't see the sun for about six months at a time.
It's overrated. I've seen the sun, baby. I leave it where it is. I like this time of year when it tends to leave me alone from 3:30 in the afternoon onward. But also this week we have some special guests. The senior editor of MacWorld, Chris Breen. Chris, now you're in the San Francisco rough general area where life is easy. The surf is high, and the guitars are tuned almost automatically. Is that still the case?
That is still the case. Surf is up today. The surf report is very positive. It's a miracle that I'm here today at all, except for the fact that I don't surf because I'm not all that great a swimmer. But if I were, I would not be here. I'd be out there with the other stooges waiting for that wave that comes by every 20 minutes or so that you could try to surf on. But because I am in the Santa Cruz area, if you're no good, the other surfers will let you know by drowning you.
It's a very clean user interface, and every time you're on a podcast, I do have to ask you, what is the album of the week?
Prominently on display behind you. The album of the week is right there in the background is Nick Lowe and his cowboy outfit, and I brought that in today because, as you know, AC/DC has come to the iTunes store, but there's a solid chunk of the Nick Lowe catalog missing from iTunes, and this is part of the period that's missing. It's too bad because the cowboy outfit albums are some of Nick's best.
He's definitely in the category of misfit songwriters.
He is, but he's a very solid songwriter. Nick is one of my favorite songwriters. He's kind of gone into the crooning thing now after realizing that, unlike AC/DC and some of these other bands, that when they hit their 60s and 70s doing the same stuff they did when they were 23, sometimes doesn't work very well. So Nick has decided to write about adult themes, not adult themes, but themes for adults. And it works out pretty well.
Excellent. And rounding out our cast is Tanya Angst, editor-in-chief of Tidbits Publishing. Tanya, always great to talk to you.
Hi, it's really nice to be here.
Now, you share much the same weather pain as I do, because we're both like Northeasterners. You're not New Englander, but we're both Northeasterners.
That's absolutely right. We have, 40 degrees, kind of sunny, but the sun's so low it hardly gets over the horizon. You know, we're all into squash and apples and pumpkin seeds and things like that right now.
Yes, you're most of your time these days is spent mulling things.
Exactly. If we're not mulling food, we're mulling, philosophical things that you can only think about when it's not very sunny. So you aren't just out surfing. You have to go more internal or something. Yes, mulling.
Yes. Well, we've got a whole bunch of really cool topics to talk about this time. Let's start off with the potpourri category of just a roundup of interesting stories. And Chris, you kind of teased one of the interesting ones. AC/DC long been one of the few remaining holdouts from the iTunes catalog. Big press release saying that the entire AC/DC catalog is now available through iTunes. It's got to be thought of as sort of a the front man is a man who stomps around stage. He's a septuagenarian, am I correct? Dressed as a schoolboy mm-hmm. uniform, yet demanding that we treat him with the dignity accorded with some an artist who does not want his songs to be digital. Why? What finally broke his usual dignity, decorum, and composure on this topic, do you think?
Well, Andy, there's something in the world called money. And when people
I'm a freelancer. You don't have to explain this concept to me.
Oh, okay. Well, back in the day when we had this stuff called gold, and you would put it in large amounts and you'd give it to people because it was rare and therefore it was valuable. Now we print it on paper, which is really worth nothing, but we say it is. And so what they've done is apparently they printed enough of this stuff and put it in large enough boxes and delivered it to the members of AC/DC that AC/DC has now said, well, there seems to be enough in here. So, yes, we would more than be happy to abandon our previous stance that people couldn't buy our stuff as songs, but instead they'd have to buy them as albums. Because, as you know, AC/DC's work is through composed. I mean, it's the kind of thing that Schubert considered seriously whenever he was creating, some of his work, and certainly Mozart was the same way. Didn't feel that their work should be parsed out in little bits and pieces and just taken around to various courts, but instead they wanted the entire piece played. And that is the kind of integrity that AC/DC has until you bring them a large enough box of money, at which point that concern seems to go out the window.
So he wants to imagine like a giant, like two balance scale, with one of those balances, the pan containing the dignity of AC/DC and their rights as an artist, and the other being an empty pot. And for the past, 10 years, Apple's have been dropping like one gold coin at a time. Yeah. And again, the guy in the shorts has been saying, come on, keep it coming. Feeling pride. Still have integrity. Still keep it coming. Too much integrity.
They have a new album out, too, which makes a big difference. So I think it was at this point they said, how are people acquiring albums these days? Are they going down to their local town? No, that's gone. No, that's gone too. Who's selling music anymore? Well, it appears to be that we could go to Amazon but the thing is that AC/DC's fans are sort of at that demographic, that 60s and 70s who aren't still quite sure how to use Amazon. So they're trying to get them into iTunes. And so at this point, they said, all right, fine. If people are going to buy our new stuff, they really need to get to it. And I think I've enraged every AC/DC fan in the world. I apologize.
They're lovely human beings. Their catalog is perfectly fine. The only times I've ever been disappointed with them is when I did need that one or two tracks of theirs that I've heard of that I'm really into and wanted to buy them. Like is that usually the reason why there are any holdouts whatsoever? Has it always been about, hey, I saw that the Beatles managed to get a great deal because they held out. We're as good as the Beatles, even though we just completed our three non-contiguous state tour of the East Coast and West Coast. Or is there principle involved here?
There actually are some artists who hold out for principle. For example, Garth Brooks, who you know is the guy who... let's see, can you see me here? Hang on.
He's the alter ego of Chris Peterson's.
Yeah, I got to do this. And then, no, the man famous for jamming his thumbs into his belt, which was a huge look during the 80s. So he was... He was demanding that his catalog be introduced by Eddie Q coming on stage with his thumbs in his belt, and that would interrupt the whole shirt outside, you know, untucked shirt thing, because, you know, that's how Apple does it these days. So he refused to do that. So far, Garth Brooks is not in there because he can't get that from Apple. But actually, King Crimson, which is one of my favorite bands, run by a guy named Robert Fripp, they are not on iTunes and unlikely to be, because Fripp is very, very concerned about the quality of their music, and he wants it marketed a certain way. He wants the sound quality to be a certain way. And this is much like the Zappa estate that actually came to iTunes not terribly long ago. So, yeah, there are some artists who just say, you know, we really want to preserve the quality of our music and the way it's marketed. And in case of a wonderful but kind of a niche band like King Crimson, Fripp is making enough money and he feels like, I don't need to do that. So yes, there absolutely are artists out there who feel like they don't want to market their stuff through them. But increasingly, Zappa, Kid Rock has just come in, AC/DC, mm-hmm. you know, Garth, if he can get the belt thing working, will be there as well. So yeah, a lot of it's about money.
Excellent. Now, everybody's expecting this is the time of year when, as people who are known to their families and circles of friends as people who know stuff about Apple, and they usually assume that we have everything a year in advance before it's being released, so we get all those kind of cool questions. This is the one time out of the year when we're asked, when's a good time to buy a Mac? Do they ever go on sale? Because the day that we're recording this, 2 days before Thanksgiving, the Black Friday sale is the one time all year when we can say, yes, in fact, they might give you knock $10 off the price something. CNET is reporting that there's been some news in that broke in Australia of all places, where, well, for heaven's sakes, they're not Americans, but they should have a lot to be thankful for: the beaches, the beer, they're right
home
near
of AC/DC.
Home of AC/DC, there you go. Very close to Weta Studios, so you might see vacationing hobbits. Also, you get to see Leo Laporte and some other people who are there for the past few weeks. What are we really expecting very much out of the sale? I'll throw this open to anybody. Last year, I think it was like what was it? $50 off of a couple of iPads, $100 off of a couple of specific desktop Macs. Nothing to be thrilled about, especially on a selling day when they're willing to sell you a 97-inch TV for $10 and a half a cheeseburger on that kind of a sale day. Is it any reason to be lined up in front of an Apple store?
It's the only time that Apple, exactly what you said, Andy, it's the only time that Apple ever does an Apple store sale, and they will take a very small amount of money off of certain products, not every product by any stretch of the imagination. And even though Black Friday is an American thing, Apple does it as their only international sale. So in Canada and Australia and all these other countries, we're getting Black Friday sales. We have no idea what Black Friday is, but it's an Apple sale, so we'll show up. But more interestingly is that competing retailers, Apple authorized retailers, will typically sell for less than Apple, especially the online ones. So while if you go to an Apple store, you will get that $10 knocked off your $1,000 computer, if you shop around a little bit, you can often find a better deal from a reseller.
Mm. Now, do you celebrate up in Canada?
We have Boxing Day the day after Christmas, where we put on the pugilism gloves and wade into the stores and try and beat our way to a deal. So we don't actually have Black Friday, except Apple does the Black Friday sale. So everyone is very confused, but lining up.
Well, some things don't translate. I should have known, because I could see you've got a nice camera there, a nice HD camera, so I can see the beginnings of your big black handlebar mustache, because for the pugilism, you do want to get the old-timey, you know, buck the swimming costume, the hair real cream down the middle.
It helps you line up the fists.
I saw a film strip on Canadian culture when I was in fourth grade, and that's pretty much what they said that they do up there. Could have been incorrect. At the time, it was a 1963 strip, and I know you've had a couple changes in prime ministers since then, so I hope I didn't I hope I'm not getting anything wrong. let's see. Reports that LTE-based fourth generation iPads are finally arriving in the Apple stores, not yet available for sales, but they are at least arriving in stores, again, underscoring the idea that maybe they're going to be on sale / for sale on Friday for Black Friday. Has anybody, like, pre-ordered one of these things?
No.
I'm sorry.
Deep silence.
Yeah, exactly. You have. Now, what was it that made you pull the trigger on this one?
I always get the LTE iPad because I use them for tethering, and that it just lasts 24 hours. Right. It's the best tethering device I've ever had. So I ordered both the iPad 4 and the iPad mini with LTE. And the iPad 4, I just yesterday got the shipping notification saying it would arrive late November. I still haven't gotten one for the iPad mini, and I ordered within minutes of it going live. So I'm guessing they're still struggling to get those things out.
Yeah. It seems as though there really is that gap between the people who are really, really into iPad. They really, really want to get the hot hardware, but they know that the LTE model with the iPad mini as well is going to be delayed about a month. So there's always that 1 month period in which sort of the neophytes who just wanted an iPad and bought the Wi-Fi as soon as it was available are being asked by these experts, like, can I run a benchmark on your iPad? Can I hold your iPad 4? I heard it was a little bit heavier than the old one. Gosh, I want an iPad 4. It's nice to have a little bit of equity and balance, isn't there?
I bought the Wi-Fi one because I needed to get a review up on time, but then I gifted it to a family member, and I'm waiting on the LTE version.
Can I be your family member, Renee?
Yeah, you already are, Andy.
You are like a regular co-host, so now we're all part of the Twit family, really.
Absolutely. You're next on the list.
Excellent. It's either this or I'll sleep on your sofa for 4 days and then extend that to 4 weeks until the heat goes down back in my place. Other really good news, speaking of things heating up, more companies that are famous for their maps are trying to get their maps into the iOS App Store to make up for perceived and real deficiencies in iOS 6's built-in Maps app. Nokia released Here Maps, which I installed yesterday, I think, and really, the best way to describe it and the best way to compliment it and the best way to promote it is to say essentially gives you back everything that you lost from the iOS 5 Maps app. So you get scrolling maps. You can download manually map sections into the device so you can use it offline. It will give you route directions. It would also give you walking directions and subway transit directions. It includes traffic as well. This is also on the heels of more information that Google is working harder and harder on getting their own Google Maps app, iOS native and ready for App Store deployment. I'm wondering if all the things that went wrong with the deployment of Apple's Maps app, the worst thing that they did was to open the door so wide to all of these competitors, because you don't want, if you're making a mobile device and making an operating system for that mobile device, you really don't want anybody else to be using a different photo service. You don't want people to be using things like a different map service, because that's one of the most forward-facing, user-centric apps that they use in a mobile device. And I'm hoping that this doesn't turn into a thing where Maps becomes the built-in Maps app becomes sort of like the third string or just one of three that are available. And if you put six iPhones on a dinner table when you're going out to eat, you might find a complete spectrum of different mapping solutions. And do you think that that's going to be kind of a problem going forward, Chris? Or does Apple have a chance to just keep getting the Maps app better and take sort of the Internet Explorer approach, where the fact that this thing is pre-installed on all devices means it's going to be the de facto wonderful app that everybody wants to use?
I conducted an experiment this morning, and I looked at the number of followers that John Gruber has. And so I decided that is the pool, and that's about 250,000 people. So these are the people that are really going to care about it and are the ones that are going to experiment with different Maps apps. I think Apple has sold about 70 trillion iOS devices. Those people aren't going to care. They're going to get Maps on there and say, I don't even know that there is another Maps app. I don't care. This, look, I tap this and I get a map. That's what I wanted, right? So I don't think that they know that what they're missing for the most part. I think those people that are picking up iOS devices get them and they use a subset of their features and are happy with the features that come with it. So yes, among us in that 250,000 person pool, it will make a difference. But I think long term, and I have to suspect that Apple thinks this as well, that okay, so the next version of Maps is going to have transit directions and it will have walking directions and they'll give you something hopefully like Street View because people have been missing that as well. I like here as well, but I don't see that my mother or sister or friends that are using iOS devices are going to jump on it and say, ah, I haven't had transit directions. How was I supposed to survive on this thing? There are people that that's a key feature for, but the general user, I don't think so. So I think Apple's probably fine.
Has everybody used that app yet? I thought it was a nice app, and I like the having restored that those missing functions. But it's definitely a port of something that was definitely not born anywhere in the Cupertino school district.
Yeah, because I find those little tabs at the bottom kind of distracting. I understand why they're doing it, but for those who haven't used it, if you select a destination, it shows you what's nearby, and you can make that go away. But most of the time, I don't care about what's about me. If I need that, I'll go to Yelp or go to something else. So I think that they've taken up a little too much real estate for that kind of functionality. I'd like it to be something I can optionally pull up and show for just a bit and then have it disappear.
I tried playing with it this morning.
Yeah, I tried playing with it most of the morning and trying it with Apple Maps and trying it with the old Google-powered maps on an older device. And it's really interesting. First of all, I think they deserve a lot of credit for shipping. While Google's like, oh, Apple ditched our maps. We're worried they won't approve it. And just Nokia just put out a press release and then put out an app. It's nowhere near as fully featured as the Windows 8 version of Nokia Maps. I don't think anyone expected it to be. But it's a little bit oddly featured, too. For example, there is turn-by-turn voice direction for walking, but not for driving. And arguably, driving is much more valuable to have voice direction for than walking. But the transit stuff was pretty good. It was as accurate as the other maps when I tried it in my local area. And it's not as sexy as Apple Maps, but I think it's the utility is all there.
Yeah. As it happened, I spent yesterday driving around Boston with Nokia's vice president, who does like most of the mapping initiatives, and he's also very involved in Navtech, and explained to me how every time I talk to somebody who works on maps for any different platform, I'm always amazed at how delicate that balance is between the analog features and the digital features, because it's one thing to make sure that you can outfit a car with all these LiDARs and all these cameras and all these sensors on the wheels to map out where all the roads are and where all the traffic signs are. But at some point, if you want to make it useful, you have to figure out how to get the greater sense of what that map information is telling you. Later on, as we're having coffee later on, he was telling me about how some things like hospitals are so important that they don't trust just the street information. They don't trust any of the sources that they get. They actually send someone down to that hospital to make sure that it's there, that it accepts patients. And not only that, but they also make sure that they map where the entrance to the emergency room is, because Nokia's map data is also provided to in-car dash navigation system. So if they press that button on that user interface that says, take me to a hospital right now, they don't want to send people to the service entrance. So, I mean, Nokia is kind of a stock horse, I think. Not people don't understand how much they have invested and involved in maps, and so once we have it feels like we have three different highly motivated companies here. We have Google Maps you could say that they were the people who first made the dumb investment in maps, back when investing in mapping was just a dumb thing that was not going to turn into a profitable product. You have Nokia that's been in this business sort of in a quiet way for years and years and years. And now you've got Apple that now has eight things that they want to prove in making things good. I mean, it's still the great maps is still the prettiest mapping app out there. It's still the one that if I'm plop down in the middle of a strange city and I want to get a sense of where I am in that city and how to get from A to B, I'm certainly not going to be opening the Nokia app. It's certainly going to be Maps. So this is one area in which I'm really hoping that it becomes personal and spiteful between the three of them and everybody's trying to deliver more and better features with each passing week. Let's see. It's an interesting thing where a Flipboard, which is that wonderful newsreader app that I'm sure everybody uses for iOS, new little twist. They've done a deal with Apple that they have, the app can give you sections based on Flipboard, based on Twitter, based on curated feeds that they provide themselves. Now Apple is going to be providing an iBooks section, which you would hope would be like Kindle previews, where you can where it'll automatically give you the first couple of chapters of every book that's interesting. It's more of an advertising thing, where the Flipboard panel will give you the cover of the book, and you'll also get to see sort of like descriptive information, and it's more of a discovery tool than a reading tool. But it's interesting that Apple is making that sort of out-of-body insertion into an outside app. Tanya, is this what a company, even Apple, has to do if they're trying to sell books and introduce people to $30 hardcovers that they hadn't heard of before?
Well, I thought the whole thing was just really unexpected. I was not expecting that Apple would be flexible enough to even consider something like this. And I did update my copy of Flipbooks and take a quick look. And naturally, I, of course, looked immediately at the computer book section to see what books I had helped work on, or someone who I knew had written, you know, what was there. And
I think if I interrupt you for 1 second, we have multiple book authors here. We all do exactly that. As soon as we go into any bookstore, even a digital one, we have to see where our books have been shelved.
Oh, absolutely. It's you look to see if your book is there, and then you kind of squint. So if there's some horrible typo on the cover, you don't notice. So I thought it was just completely unexpected. Speaking as actually a publisher, which is more my current role, it doesn't seem like the iBookstore is a very, I don't know, flexible, turn on a dime kind of operation. And it was surprising to me that the Flipbook people had managed to make this deal. I think it's kind of interesting. I wonder how many people reading Flipbook will kind of understand when they see the little iBooks logo, you know, exactly what they're doing, you know, how they're interacting. And then, of course, as a publisher, I also noticed that the various publishers are having varying levels of success with getting their book descriptions to show up with nice formatting. And I certainly hope that's something that will improve.
Mm. Now, is discoverability a solvable problem? I mean, yesterday happened to be the first time I was in a real bricks and mortar comic book shop in like 3 or 4 weeks. And I wound up coming out with a lot of books because it was I buy most of my books from Comixology, but in Comixology, you can't take it off the shelf, flip through every single page just to see if there's things that are leaping out at you. You don't get to, it's more difficult to really take that 5-minute walk to the store and just look for book covers that are interesting to you. I mean, how do publishers solve that problem of introducing new content to people when they know that there must be one good book in there? It's just a case of making sure they get their eyeballs on it.
I think it's a huge problem, and I don't think anybody really has a great answer. I mean, the nice thing for a publisher with a real bookstore, you know, back in the day, was you could, as a publisher, identify some books or authors that you thought had the potential to be very successful, and you would do things like buy a position on the end of an aisle, so your book could be more featured, or your author would go around to bookstores, Barnes and Noble, Borders, whatever, and your author would actually, you know, sign books and have you know, events where your author could appear. And those things still happen, and sometimes they happen online. But it does seem that the ability to sell a book, you know, sort of, and to have it interact with the real world where you get some kind of control over the presentation of the book is slipping away. When a publisher is dealing with selling online, pretty much the main way that the publisher has any means at all of conveying anything about the tone of the book or the style of the publisher is in the tiny little thumbnail that is used to show the book's cover. That's kind of it. And then it just kind of goes out there into the online universe, and you hope the cover, you know, appears with the right proportion, so it's not, you know, squished or wide or something, and hopefully some of the metadata that describes the book goes with it. But I think discoverability is a huge problem for publishers. It kind of levels the playing field in some ways, because very small publishers can look just as impressive as very large publishers. But with so many people wanting to write and publish books, it can make it more difficult for any individual person or publisher to draw attention to what they're doing, because there's not a lot of signaling that you can use to signal that this is important, or at least, you know, this has a lot of money behind it.
You know, I wouldn't be too disappointed if one of my books were there in Flipboard. It's like, it's often a little bit heartbreaking when you spend like 3 to 6 or 7 months writing a book, and then people ask, "So, have you got a new book out?" I said, "Yeah, it's been available for 6 weeks, and they tried to promote it, but I did a good job on it."
I think it's really nice that Apple's pushing. I think it's really nice that Apple's not waiting for people to go to the iBook store, though, and is actually taking that content to where people already are, which is in the Flipboard. Maybe other apps that people go to for news and stuff like that will be a place where Apple continues to push it. And I'm glad they're not doing the traditional thing where we sit in the iBook store and we wait for you. It's kind of nice to see them putting it out there.
Now, is that unusual, though? I mean, I think one of the long time complaints a lot of people have had about other content in the iTunes store is that it's not as easy to independently recommend music and apps and TV shows and other content. There's a share link and there's a gift link, but it's not as though it's easy for me to create, let's say, a storefront whose job it is my own storefront that's nothing but recommendations of content you can buy through these stores. It just seems like this is sort of the first time Apple has said, we are going to actually go to some trouble to give our store a presence in somebody else's app, an app that we don't control. And Chris, have you ever seen that before?
Ping, Andy, Ping. What about the glorious Ping?
Well, we all know about Ping, but I'm saying a second success.
Ah, right. Yeah. No, I think that it may have been that after the disaster that was Ping, maybe Apple gathered together, at least the people, the great minds behind all this, just like, you know, we don't do this very well. And we need to get out of our little universe that we don't do very well and find other ways to expose people to this kind of content. Particularly when you have an outfit like Amazon that uses your buying history and is able to recommend things to you. So at least as a customer, the discovery on Amazon is really good because they're very smart about what they push at you. So far, Apple doesn't seem to be very good at that. They sort of tried that through Ping and it was terrible. I'm glad to see that they are venturing out now, and I would like to see them take customer data, if I allow them to, and push recommendations at me. Their Genius feature works pretty well within iTunes and within some of the iOS apps. So bring that kind of capability, shovel that out to another app rather than reinventing the wheel, but do things like Flipboard where people are accustomed to using it. They can flip through here, see the kind of customer recommendations that a Genius feature might offer, share that data with the other application, and you're going to drive traffic back to the iBook store or to iTunes or to other things like that. So discoverability is so difficult, but having that customer data is key. And I think Apple really needs to try to leverage that a little better than they have so far.
And do you remember, Andy, that they banned a bunch of, well, they didn't ban, but they strongly suggested that people don't make clones of the App Store in the App Store, but try to find different ways of displaying and discovering content. And maybe that prefaced this a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of feel as though Apple is coming to the realization that they used the last of their magic marketing beans on the iPad, and so now if they can't just simply say, here is our non-compatible, completely self-contained social media service. Now wait, don't everybody rush at once. Let our staff stay to the side so we don't get trampled. Anybody? We're safe to the sides now. Thank you for waiting. Crickets, crickets, crickets.
Got punch and pie.
It's free beer. One last thing before we take a break. An amusing blunder Apple made on their official tech specs pad sheet for the iPad. They were supposed to, on the dimensions of the thing, they were supposed to say that it was 0.37 inches thick. They said it was actually 0.37 millimeters thick. And it has since been fixed, but not before everybody was able to screenshot it, have a good laugh at its expense. And now it's our turn. Because here's a list of things that are about a third of a millimeter. That is the size of one pixel on a standard CRT. If you take a third of a millimeter slice of a mouse brain, according to a biologist, that contains just 20 layers of neurons. Limestone is composed of the corpses of single-celled organisms, each of which are about a third of a millimeter thick. Porcelain teeth veneers, known to some, I will not say who, of Apple senior executive team, also one third to one half of a millimeter. The smallest spider in the world is the Patu Diga spider. Anybody want to take a guess as to where that spider can be found? Yes, Cupertino. You read the show notes. It's in Colombia. Its body, the male of the species, is just a third of a millimeter long. Human hair, if it's in, I learned as I was researching this, the human hair has a resting phase and a growth phase. And a resting phase, as the name implies, it's not actually growing much at all. In a growth phase, it grows about a third of a millimeter per day. But now we've had a bit of fun, but now here's the operative question. Since they actually said that the iPad 4 is about a third of a millimeter on their official company site, and this has been well documented, can we create a class action suit to force them to build a version of the iPad 4 and sell it to us for $499 that is one third of a millimeter thick? Chris, we got to go to you because you are the iPad, iPod, iOS expert.
Right. Well, the fact is this was not a mistake. It was a leak. And so, iPad 5, clearly it's going to be one third of a millimeter thin.
I know this is the last time I'm going to be given advanced product, but here is the new iPad 4. I don't know if you can, I'm going to try to, I can't really zoom it in, but I'm holding it on edge here, but oh man. And also the responsiveness. It's also very, very light is the thing. Holy crap. I just dropped it. Okay. we're going to take a break while I look for my, it was a loner too. We're going to take a break. Leo Laporte has an important message from our friends at, which we got, I had a list in front of me here. There we go. From our friends at Ford. Leo.
Break Weekly brought to you today by Ford and the fabulous Ford Sync. Do not buy a car. Do not buy a car if it doesn't have Ford Sync on it. For your own peace of mind, your own safety, Ford Sync. The whole idea of Ford Sync is you keep your hands on the wheel, your eyes on the road, but you're still connected to the real world outside, the internet. Sync lets you, it's voice-activated technology that does everything you want to do without, you know, the danger of looking down, twiddling a knob, or looking at a screen. You can enjoy your drive, but still do things like listen to your favorite music. You can, when you're listening to a song with Sync, you can say, play similar music, and you'll get more of the same, more, you know, unique, similar stuff. Similar but different, if you know what I mean. You can voice control your music no matter how it's stored, too. I love that. On your smartphone, via Bluetooth streaming on a USB drive, an MP3 player, an iPad, an iPhone. Works great with the iPhone 5. I love this idea. So play similar music, and if you hear something you like in your MP3 player, it also has shuffle, repeat, play next track. I just love it. iTunes tagging on available Sync with My Ford Touch and HD Radio. You can tag a song and then buy it later via iTunes automatically. Love it. Browse all audiobooks. You can dial the radio by saying FM 94.7. How about that? Or if you've got a preset, FM preset 1 or whatever. Best of all, Ford is offering Sync now on every 2012, 2013 Ford vehicle sold in the U.S., including that hot new 2012 Ford Focus. Visit Ford.com/technology. You can find out more. And you know what I'd do? I'd go to a Ford dealer and test drive Sync. Yeah, you'll have to drive a car too, but you know what? I'm going for the Fusion, the new 2013 plug-in hybrid Fusion. Ooh. And yes, it has Sync. Ford.com/technology. Check it out today. We thank Ford so much for all of their support on the Twit Network. Meanwhile, back to Mac Break Weekly.
Thank you very much, Leo. 9 to 5 Mac has some reports about macOS 10.9. Not anywhere close to being released to developers yet, but they say that they have talked to people who have had their hands on a pre-release development edition, and they claim that it might include Siri on the desktop, and it's incorporated much the same way that it's incorporated in iOS 6. They also claim to believe that, Maps is going to be coming to the desktop with macOS 10.9. They don't mention anything like an actual version of the Maps app coming for macOS, but they do mention something akin to the MapKit resource available for developers, so that if a developer wants to include Maps and Maps data inside a desktop app, they can just simply call these APIs. size. And of course, Apple does not yet create desktop machines or laptops that have GPS in them. But remember that all the Find My Mac features, they do rely on network information to get a pretty good fix on where you are. So it's not as though they'll be starting from zero. Interesting ideas. It's still probably way too early to even talk about what 10.9 is going to contain. But the thing that sort of leapt out at me about all this stuff is that Maps and Siri, they're both really, really keyboard phobic, keyboard hostile sort of apps. It's the sort of apps that you have that either are enabled by having a big flat multi-touch glass screen in front of you, or they allow you to just completely ignore the fact that you have a keyboard. I mean, if I've got a keyboard in front of me on a desktop and I have a search dialogue, why would I necessarily want to have to reach out, press a button on the keyboard, take my hand off that keyboard, and then say something that Siri might then misinterpret when I could just simply type that same sentence and get greater accuracy? Renee, you were a little bit closer to the ground on things inside of Apple than I know that I am. What do you think about these features for 10.9? Does that make sense to you that we're going to see those in the next version of the OS?
Yeah, I mean, Apple started that with Back to the Mac, that event they had about 2 years ago when they started talking about how things they developed for iOS, like QuickTime X, would have value on OS X, and then Mountain Lion only increased that by making all the apps that, you know, giving them the same names as their iOS counterpart. So instead of Address Book, you have Contacts, and instead of iCal, you have Calendars. And I think that the next version is just going to continue that. So they'll still have their own underpinnings, their own architecture. They won't be the same OS yet, but the interface and the way that we relate to them will become similar. For example, right now with iOS maps, you can share location, but that goes to a Mac, and Apple has no web map component the way Google does. So it makes it a challenge. What do you do to resolve shared location when you're running a Mac? And having iOS 6 style maps on the Mac would make that, you know, very sorry Windows users, but that would make it very easy for Mac people to share a location back and forth. And Siri, if you listen to the way Apple talks about it, it's almost like the natural language interface. And it's not there yet. It's the Apple One or the Lisa, not really the Apple II or the Mac yet. But it's the next sort of interface where Apple gets these headless applications. And a lot of the stuff that they've been doing with both iOS and macOS, things like splitting Springboard into Springboard and Backboard and porting over XPC to iOS, I think we'll let Apple do this kind of communication and almost invisible applications that's going to make using a Mac, even if you have a keyboard or no keyboard, just much more powerful in the next year.
Yeah. But I do think that if they're looking to bring the OS for the desktop OS forward, I've never been a fan of the idea that Apple's has a plan to get rid of macOS and to fuse their mobile and their desktop operating systems the same thing. At the same time, we're kids are growing up in a world in which they expect computers to have a touchscreen on them. And I can't tell you how many times when I've been using my iPhone or my iPad for a couple hours, and then I switch to my notebook, and of course I reach out to the screen to tap something, and oh wait, this is I need to do the trackpad for that sort of thing. I mean, I really have been turned around from a couple of years ago when I think it was during a Steve Jobs keynote. He was saying that we have looked into so many ways of integrating touch screens into the Mac, but we know that this is not a touch interface. It's a natural progression. I think when he was rolling out the iPad, he was talking about how it just doesn't belong on desktop operating systems. I've kind of come around on that, though, because there's the commercial now for a bunch of Windows 8 devices that uses the heavily mocked and maybe justly so a Windows 8 desktop machine from, I think, Sony. That's a 22-inch desktop computer, but it has a kickstand that kind of can collapse so that if you want to actually put it on an easel, you can put it on an easel. So it's fun to make a joke about this being the 22-inch iPad, but then you hand this to, you put this within on the table in front of a kid, and they want to put their handprints on it. They want to draw with it on the screen. And when you have it on an easel that's next to your sofa, you do want to use it to control your TV and to look things up on IMDb. Am I just kind of nuts here, or is there a way to put multi-touch into macOS that would make it a much, much better and much more familiar experience for regular consumers?
I'm the same as you, Andy. I had the same thought. You know, it wouldn't be a good experience, but the more you get used to the disintermediation of iOS, there's no keyboard to get in your way. There's no trackpad to get in your way. It's almost one-to-one manipulation. It's like finger painting
productivity. You're touching the interface. You're touching the software. That's where you, that's Absolutely. How you think of your interaction with the computer.
And it's well, it's not it.
Another thing to keep in mind is that more people are setting up their desks so that they can use a desktop computer, but they're standing. And when you're standing, it's a much more ergonomically sensible setup for using your finger right on the screen. And I think that's something that maybe I recall when Steve Jobs was talking about how Apple did research and they felt that it wasn't a good ergonomic setup to have a touchscreen on a laptop. And of course, he could have just been saying that to sort of distract us. But I think also they might not have been considering the standing desk. And I think it would be fabulous at the standing desk.
Mm. Yeah, I think
Go ahead, Chris, I'm sorry.
Apple is engaged in, they're talking about Apple not doing anything terribly disruptive right now. And I think actually they are. I think they're changing the way we interact with our devices and with our information. And I think one of the things they've done is gone back to ground zero and thought, well, let's rethink the whole way that we interact with these devices. So, for example, using one of these things is kind of stupid if you've ever seen a four-year-old use a computing device. You show them an iPhone or an iPad, and they're all over it, and they've got it down in about 10 minutes. You then put them in front of a computer with a mouse, and they've got this level of abstraction where they say, what, I'm supposed to move this in order for this? It's like the crank machines at the carnival, you know, where you're trying to manipulate the joystick and get the little fuzzy animal out of it, which you never can get because it's rigged, just so you know. But you can't get these things either. But it's a totally stupid way to interact with stuff. We're used to it because we've been doing it forever. But you don't have to. Touch is much more natural. So remove that level of abstraction. And now you're touching things. And that makes sense. So I do think that this is, I hope this is a thought out effort on their part, that they've got the idea that 5 years from now, it's all going to be about touch. And we're not going to be doing these abstract things. Instead, we're actually be touching our data and moving it around. And so, yeah, I think that's kind of where all this is going.
If I could steal a page from Guy English's notebook, and he writes a lot of really intelligent stuff about this. Touch doesn't have to actually be physical touch, and there was a lot of concern that, you know, OS X, unlike iOS, is not optimized for touch. There's no 44-point touch targets. A lot of the controls are small, but natural language doesn't just have to be Siri. I know, Andy, you speak to a lot of the same navigation people that I do, and they originally said they didn't leave microphones on listening for you to talk all the time because of battery concerns. But now Macs are plugged in where they have really big batteries, and not only could you keep a microphone plugged on so I can just, you know, have that famous Scotty line, Siri, computer, and have it answer me, but I can start using gestures in the air. We have cameras in all of our Macs, and when you get Kinect-style gesture recognition, I no longer have to be directly touching a screen to manipulate objects, but I can still have the same almost tactile manipulation from a little bit of a distance.
Mm. We're already seeing some of the problems that Microsoft is having, trying to get all their users to understand that we're trying to give you something new to play with that we think is going to make the platform better. I've always been disappointed that natural language, even when you just simply type it out, hasn't been embraced as widely as it really should be. Because I do want to create appointments by saying, schedule lunch with Debbie a week from Tuesday at the same place I had lunch with her last time, and include a note to the last Microsoft Word document we discussed, and have it be able to do the right searches to sort of parse that out. I'm trying to figure out how many leaps it would take to get people to suddenly both disagree on what the air gestures are going to be in order to you know, make things happen, and then decide that they actually would prefer to do that learn how to make those gestures as opposed to simply saying, yeah. I mean, you can sort of imagine like all the snarky comments. Yeah, you know what? Command Option L. Wow, that really wore me out. Thanks so much, Apple, for making things simpler for me. I mean, Apple does have an advantage. Kind of almost a disadvantage, because Microsoft didn't have to bring everybody on board all at once, because they usually are at least 2 years behind where their users want to go. I mean, it was only recently that Windows XP stopped being the most popular operating system out there. Mac, everybody's on the same page, on the same drumbeat by Apple's design. So if they were to do something major to disrupt how people normally use their Macs and people didn't like that, that could be a really bad thing, don't you think?
But look who their future customers are. They're not Mac users. They're people that have come up with iOS devices. And so where we may dislike some of the stuff that they've done with Mount Lion and some of these very iOS sort of features, those people have started out with an iPad or an iPhone. run over to a Mac and say, oh, I know what that is. Launchpad. I totally get that. Where the rest of us will go, why would you launch things that way? That's the clumsiest way you could possibly do it. Because I'm used to it. So I think Apple is looking forward and saying, no, our customer base really did start out with this interface, and we're going to integrate as much of that stuff that we can so that they're familiar when they get in here, and we're going to continue moving in that direction.
And I don't think that it has to be one or the other. I would be very surprised if it was so gesture-driven that people who are accustomed to keyboard shortcuts or, you know, menus or whatever they want to do, that it still wouldn't work. I don't see think there's any reason why you couldn't still have a mouse or trackpad working.
And also, that's one of the limitations of the iPad. If you're trying to make this $500, or in my case, $800 computer pull its weight, there are times when I really do want to reach out and touch the screen instead of using the keyboard. But there are times when I just want to boldface something by hitting two keys on my keyboard instead of having to hit this little tiny little touch target in the middle of the screen. I wish they would work on that just a little tiny bit. But that is an excellent point. I mean, we always want things to. What's the old saying that whatever music you were listening to as a teenager will define what you think of as good music for the rest of your life? And maybe it's the same thing going on with computer operating systems and interfaces, because I grew up with the Mac OS. I'm sorry, I pre-grew up with the Apple IIe, but my first big boy computer, defined as maybe age 14, 15 onward, was a mouse and a screen, and that is the most natural way for me to use things. I think I adapted nicely to multi-touch, but at the same time, I still instinctively think that speed and power means keyboards and command shortcuts. So, I mean, how long do people have to before this age of people dies out and lets the revolution take control of the command center?
Yeah, I think that's happening. I mean, if you observe, again, I look at my daughter use this stuff, and touch is so natural to her, and speech would be as well. And whereas this is clumsy, using a keyboard is clumsy to her, and using a mouse is clumsy for her. So I do think that Apple, if it's smart, and so far it's demonstrated that it generally is really saying, okay, fine, we're sort of like the Republican Party. We've got, you know, old white people that are going to die out, and that'll be it for us. Sorry, now I've angered them too.
Wasn't there like a three-letter acronym for like a K-M-I-K for like mouse icon menu interfaces as a generic? So now we're going to talk about that as the OLM, the OWM, the old white man interface.
Right. And I think that they're really thinking, okay, so what's going to happen in the future? We've got the devices. We've got this under our belts. We could continue to do things the way we have been doing it, but really this is the direction we need to go, because it is more natural. And part of the evidence is that you see that Microsoft's starting to do it, which I think demonstrates like, oh, this is a trend, because they finally caught up a couple of years later.
Well, another part of it also is trying to help more people be able to use the computer. So even back in the day when older people who are older now, guy or girl, use the Macs, we spent a lot of time with the menus on the menu bar and the keyboard shortcuts listed there. And we actually thought it was interesting to read tips that led us on to special keyboard shortcuts that were in the menus. I don't think anybody does that anymore, because for the most part, where we look at our applications to figure out how to get things done is on toolbars or on little doohickey controls that are grouped right around the edge of the monitor. So the whole menu and keyboard shortcut thing, I would argue, is already old. And just speaking personally, I used to be a total keyboard shortcut girl. I mean, oh my God, I was all over them. But since I had my son almost 14 years ago and went through the whole lack of sleep thing and now the working mom thing, it's like my brain can only hold so much. And a lot of those keyboard shortcuts, they're not in my brain anymore. So I myself have moved forward. I'm not saying it's a good thing, because I think it's sort of a stupid thing, but I've moved forward and I'm much more dependent on the user interface. And I bet Andy and Chris that you guys actually are too. And so I think it's just kind of a natural evolution away from using the written language and asking people to memorize a lot of information to more of a situation where what you need to know just appears in front of you in a somewhat more visual or graphical way.
Hmm. Well, there's actually a good example of that. I'm starting to wonder if discoverability is as big of an issue as I and a lot of other people used to make it out to be. I definitely resisted the first time that I encountered pull to refresh in an iOS app. I didn't hate it. I thought it was a good way to hide the refresh button. At the same time, I was wondering, well, who's going to just, are people going to just sort of accidentally find it? And if they don't, how many times are they going to drill through like the one tap button interfaces to try to find the refresh button if they don't find it? And now it just seems like the most natural thing ever. It seems like some of the alchemy of developing a really great app, no matter what platform you're writing it for, is to figure out ways of hiding interfaces now. It's sort of like how the way a mom would like hide spinach inside a brownie to trick people into having power features that they otherwise would be repulsed by.
I gave both my little godchildren, one is 4 years old and one is 7 years old, and I gave them both the brand new iPod Touch because they like taking pictures, and Siri became their new best friend. The older one can write, of course. The younger one has no ability to write, but he can talk to it. He thinks it's his friend. He asks it to launch apps for him, to do different things for him. And it's exactly what Tanya said. It is, my mother uses the iPad 2 as her principal computer now. She finds it way more accessible and way less intimidating than her iMac even, because she didn't grow up with computers. And my godchildren on one end, my mom at the other end, it has just made computing technology available to people in a way that it never was before.
Mm. I feel like every time I see a kid interact with a computer, I learn something about interface and learn something about usability that was just completely foreign to me before, because I'm amazed at things that I think that are complicated are actually intuitive. I think that it's a sense of play, really, that you need to bring to these apps now, and that you push every button, pull every lever, wait for the clown to come up on the spring, either laugh or start shrieking in horror at it, and then repeat the things that give you good mental chemistry feedback and avoid the things that cause you to have horrible mental chemistry feedback.
Oh, absolutely.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Say,
go ahead, Tanya.
As the mom of a boy, right? So he will sometimes kind of literally bounce off walls, and going into a computer room of seventh grade boys, first of all, they're physically bouncing off the walls. But second of all, if they will actually put themselves in front of the computer screen, they don't just, you know, gently move the mouse or tap a key and see what happens. They just bounce all over the machines also. And they absolutely do that. They try everything. If a button doesn't work on the first click, well, click it 10 more times and see what happens, or then go bounce off another wall and come back. So these kids are completely playing with the machines in a way that we probably never would, because, you know, the thing cost, you know, umpteen thousand dollars and it was probably fragile and you were supposed to be careful with it. These kids are not careful at all. And it's amazing this stuff doesn't break, but that whole playfulness where you just, you know, keep poking at it. It's more like a game where you see what it can do. Definitely is very different from the way as a teenager, you know, I recall the high school computer rooms were much more careful and quiet.
There's a guy named...
Go ahead, Renee.
So I was going to say, there's a guy named Josh Clark. He's Global Moxie on Twitter, and he goes around teaching people about gesture-based interfaces and the future of them. And it's interesting because he'll suggest things like, if someone stabs a screen three times, they're probably lost, and maybe you want to pop up a hint to show them how to go somewhere. But after they're navigating for a while, really functionally, you want to start ramping down the hints, almost make them disappear. And we have these powerful computers, and they're really in binary modes. Either it's full hints or no hints, and there's no ramping up or ramping down. But if we start going to gesture controlled Macs and Macs that can read us via the camera or talk to us via the speaker, I think once you start putting that kind of behavioral programming into it, it just unlocks all those concerns. So you don't have kids slamming buttons 10 times. You have them hitting it twice. Oh, do you need help with this? Here's where this is. And then that just disappears and you go on about your business.
There's Clippy, though.
There's always Clippy.
It's good to have a release valve specifically for the, so that you don't vent your anger against the useful parts of the app. Right. That does remind me of part of the conversation I was having with that Nokia Maps guy yesterday. Apparently, one of the ways that they test out their software and how well their algorithms are is that their test drivers who are using their software and using their directions are actually wired up with biometrics. So as not only are they collecting information where how long did the car pause at this intersection, how long did he go, did he take the wrong right instead of the wrong left, it's also taking information where what was his blood pressure, what was his pulse rate, you know, what was his galvanic skin response. So it's getting information about how well, what kind of effect the software was having on him on a second by second basis. So you imagine how good like the next FaceTime camera will be if it also can do a heat map and it can basically sense you fidgeting around and sort of sensing that, okay, I don't know what he's saying into the microphone, but the microphone just kept clipping four times in a row with something that was very, very loud. I think we're going to try to cool it on the error messages. What if we just like put a tiny warming little yellow light in the corner when there's an error instead of putting something in his face and stopping the app from working?
So you don't have to swear out loud. And that's the only time it really counts. Yeah, so, you know, I'm okay.
It gives you a lot of opportunities for localization, because in one country it's like this, and another country it's like this.
Stress detection, oh, I'm sorry. Curse detection.
I'm sorry, I thought you were saying, peace, brother. I'm having a hippie positive moment. You're actually telling me up mine. Okay, well. And on that happy note, let's take another break. We've got another message from Leo, who's got something important to say. Tell us about American Express.
Excuse me, gentlemen, if I may interrupt, I'd like to talk a little bit about American Express Savings Bank. Yeah, I'm really thrilled. Is there somebody at American Express who says, you know, that Mac Break Weekly show, that's a good show. Probably a lot of people on Mac Break Weekly who listen to Mac Break Weekly are saving money. They're good Americans. They're probably putting aside a bit of their paycheck every week to buy a new Mac or maybe a new car, a home, or just putting aside money for a rainy day. We really ought to tell them about our bank. Do you think that happened? And they said, well, let's get some ads on that Mac Break Weekly show. I think actually it is what happened, because here they are. I'm talking about American Express. Now, I've been a long time a member of American Express. Really happy to have them on as a sponsor. Since 1981, I'm an Amex Platinum card holder now. Love it. And guys, by the way, I wouldn't mind that black card, you know, if you just wanted to. I have a friend who has the Amex black card. I don't know how you get that. It's not. You have to, like, know somebody, right? That would be cool. It's very cool when you pull it out, because if you're at a nice place, they might know. Most of the time, they go, what the heck is that? And then they go, but that's not what I'm here to talk about today. Here, I'm talking about the American Express Bank. Now, I want you to visit the website, and it's kind of an unusual URL, so make a note of this. It's personalsavings.com/online-savings. personalsavings.com/online-savings. Now, what that'll do is take you to American Express Bank, FSB, member FDIC. Now, this is a high-yield savings account that works in conjunction with your existing bank account. So this is not a replacement. It's a complement to what you're using already. It's online, which means it's easy to use. You can control it via phone or the web anytime, 24/7. There's no minimums. I like that. No fees. Really good phone support. And a high yield competitive variable interest rate to help you reach your savings goals. If you're not saving, you know, you might want to be saving for that new Mac Pro if it ever comes out. This would be a great way to do it. personalsavings.com/online-savings. That's American Express Bank, FSB, member FDIC. We thank them for supporting Mac Break Weekly, and we encourage you to visit personalsavings.com/online-savings to learn more. Now back to you guys.
Leo, I don't know if you're listening to this wherever you are, but if you get yourself a 3D printer, you can have yourself as many American Express Black Cards as you want. Anyway, we had one of those iCloud service outages early this week that sort of puts that really brown dotting of the I over iCloud for that we've become so used to. Monday morning, many users, myself included, found that iTunes Match Playback just didn't work anymore for iOS or macOS, could not access your playlists or your content. Also on Sunday, for a great deal of time, both iMessage Network and the FaceTime apps were not working. FaceTime didn't work at all. If you tried to use the Messages app, on your phone, it would work, but it would have to default to text because the iMessage network was completely down. And there is a class of services and apps all across the industry where if something doesn't work properly, I assume that maybe I've screwed something up or there's something wrong at my end. When Twitter goes down, I know it's Twitter's problem. iCloud is definitely in that category. My spite pump was very much primed for this sort of news because after a year or two of iCloud and a year of iTunes Music Match, and not getting it to work at all, I just sort of switched it off and went back to manual syncing. But then at some point I decided to myself, well, you're supposed to know about these things. If it doesn't work, if nobody can make this work, then Apple would have had an apologetic letter of some sort up there. It must work for some people. You should turn yourself into one of those people who can make iTunes Match work. And so I spent hours going through I did a smart playlist and looked for every single track in my library that had some sort of an iCloud sync problem. One by one by one, I got rid of duplicates. I downloaded new copies of tracks, solved every single problem that I could find. I finally got iCloud playlist syncing working fine for about 4 days. And then, of course, my favorite playlist in the entire world disappeared off my iPhone and was not available to me for a 90-minute drive. So I'm prepared to once again think that, oh, man, iCloud, I don't want you to fail. We all want you to succeed. We all want nothing but the best for you. But it's so hard to keep loving you, iCloud, when you keep having problems like this. This was just hot on the heels of the Letterpress game, which had absolutely the best PR campaign ever, but with the help of iCloud and Game Center, by saying it's the game that was so hot it brought Game Center down. It was so popular with so much traffic. So Chris, is it me? Is it iCloud? Or is it just a relationship that was forged in the pits of hell, and that a quick divorce and acrimony and silence for the rest of our lives was just what was intended for this entire relationship?
Well, Andy, there's a word that's gone out of fashion that I think it's time we bring back, and that word is criminy. Criminy generally refers to any online effort that Apple has ever undertaken. And we could start with eWorld. We could go to iTools. We could then go to, what happened after that? .Mac and then MobileMe. And we said, no, this time they've built this into the operating system. They built this into iOS. They built this into OS X. They're really serious about it this time. They're going to make it work. I'm not going to have duplicate contacts anymore. And all my calendars are going to have just one event instead of 12 of the same one. And this guy doesn't have 12 birthdays on the same day. And my music is going to match perfectly because they have it all in the iTunes store. And how could they possibly screw up Rubber Soul, for God's sake, which is one of the most popular albums ever made? And yet, the answer is criminy. They just can't seem to get this together. We are getting to the point now, at least where this is so important to these operating systems, because it is built in and we are reliant on these things, where you are saving data to the cloud by default, that this has to be like your utility, where it just works. And when it goes out, everyone is surprised instead of criminy. So, yes, iTunes Match, which came out just a year ago. I think this is the doesn't work very well anniversary, and that not much has changed since the thing was launched. So we still have iMatch or iTunes Match, where you have album artwork that is screwy, and you have tracks should match and they don't, or you have an album and suddenly Taxman is over in all by itself in this other album when it should be with the rest of Revolver, but somehow it's not, because I don't know why. I'm hoping that this delay of iTunes 11 is a lot about them saying, really, this is, at least in terms of music, let's get this part cleaned up. Can we just make iTunes Match work for the obvious stuff, for the Beatles stuff, right? If you want to, you know, do the weird stuff with Captain Beefheart albums, that's fine, because not many people are going to notice. But for this stuff, let's get it right. And having these kind of outages where people do depend on it, where they now depend on things like messages, you can't do that. It's got to work. And we thought it would, and it's still not working yet. So I think we have backups in place. A lot of people tried iCloud. They're not happy when they've gone back to Dropbox. People are using Google services because those seem to be up all the time and iCloud doesn't. So, you know, Apple, I, the only message to you is criminy and, you know, act on that, please. Mm.
Like, who here is the only thing that I'm using iCloud for that I kind of rely on is document syncing, because that usually mostly works. I don't always know that it's synced to my iDevices without having to check for it first, but it works kind of okay. But Chris, like you said, I mean, it works for what it does, but if I store it in Dropbox instead, there's so much more I can do with it. If I put it in Microsoft SkyDrive, it's so much easier to share a link and export it so other people can access it and use it. And I mean, I don't know. I feel as though I'm using it because iCloud works well enough and it's an Apple product and they've made it a very frictionless process for me to use it. But if it were one micron more heavier to use, I would drop it in a sec. I mean, is anybody else really relying on iCloud, or are we all members of the I Give Up? We want you to succeed. We'll be back to see that success in 10.9 and iOS 7.
Well, you know, I use iCloud services, but I don't depend on them the way, you know, a brain surgeon would depend on their scalpel being in exactly the right place. So for me, it hasn't been too much of a problem. But specifically, what I use a lot is I use the calendar syncing to get it on all my devices. And, you know, if there's been some kind of small delay that was caused by an outage, I haven't noticed. I use the syncing in Safari for bookmarks, tab, reading list, blah, blah, blah. It seems to be good. But again, you know, if my tabs don't sync instantly, I'm probably not going to notice. I've certainly got enough of them as it is. So if I was missing a few, who could tell? I use Find My Friends a lot as a tracker on my teenage son. He knows it's there. It's cool with him because I pick him up a lot better if I know where he is. None of that. Oh, and PhotoStream. PhotoStream is absolutely flaky. I can see it being flaky, but I still love it because I can take photos. I actually went on vacation by myself this summer, and I was taking photos in Europe and not doing a thing, but taking them on my iPhone, and my husband and my son could watch them on the Apple TV at night here at home. And that was just totally cool, even though some of the photos never showed up. So I guess what I'm saying is it's not, like, we can see it's not working perfectly, but I'm not counting on it to work perfectly. It's more like what it does is so cool that if it's just 90%, I'm cool with it. Apple should completely get their act together and make it perfect.
Striving for 90%.
Tristan is so hosed, like, because you've already got like that speech down pat, saying, "Son, I'm not really angry with you that you dented the car that you weren't supposed to take out, because I just have learned not to expect so much of you. That's all, and so we'll get it fixed. We're glad that you crashed into a pole instead of a person. That's wonderful. We're really glad you did that, but just realize that every day you disappoint us just a little bit."
Yeah, who wants fudge? Like, you know, a solid B.
A gentlemanly B. You get to keep your scholarship and your athletic, your spot on the athletic team.
The thing for me is not so much that iCloud and the associated services go down, because everybody goes down. Microsoft goes down. Amazon goes down. Gmail has been a pain for me for 5 years. But iCloud, even when it's working, it's not great. And I think cloud services are one of the two biggest challenges that Apple's going to face. You talk about Google and they don't have great native apps. They don't have great interfaces. Well, guess what? They bought Snapseed. They bought Sparrow. They bought Slide. You can hire designers and developers and fix that problem much easier than you can fix a cloud infrastructure. That's not a trivial problem to solve. And there's very little indication that Apple is spending. I mean, they could be doing it really secretly, but the store is still running on web objects. They still have to take down the store in order to change small things and put it back up. We did a 90-minute interview with Lorne Brichter about Game Center and the Game Center APIs and building Letterpress. And it does not sound like a battle-hardened, well-tested, dog-fooded API. And Siri, I mean, a lot of stuff, like, we were laughing about iCloud and we're laughing about iMessage and we're laughing about Siri, but that's the future. Apple needs to nail services to exist in a world where Google has a great interface and Microsoft has a really good products on the line and Amazon and Facebook are maybe getting into mobile devices. And I'd love for there to be this big, aha, look, we've totally rebuilt our entire server infrastructure. We're no longer buying Azure boxes and Sun boxes and, sorry, Oracle boxes and whomever. And we've got this as fantastic as Cocoa Touch is. We now have, you know, Cocoa Cloud and it's just revolutionary. But again, there's very little sign. And that makes me incredibly scared about Apple services going forward.
Yeah, I mean, Google did sort of a really cool thing, but you could also interpret it as a victory lap for all their web apps and their cloud services, where there is a landing page for people who are doing all kinds of things during this holiday week in the U.S., where it's sort of like a path that shows you with little web app boxes for you can actually access and use. So here's the Google service that you'll use to prepare your Thanksgiving dinner. Here's a recipe box. Here is a Google live Google Hangout for live cooking lessons. I should say that when I first opened that link, it said join live cooking lessons over Hangouts. I misread that as join Jive cooking lessons over Hangouts.
Oh, boy.
Possibly because the little frame grab was of this very lovely lady in the kitchen who seemed to be making a gesture like this. And so I thought, anyway, that's neither here nor there. And there's a use our flight trackers for people who are traveling. Use our sports ticker when you're keeping up with the games. On and on and on and on. I mean, they are it's no wonder that they're good at web services because they started off life as a web services company. But it does show you that if more of the world is going to be the connected web, Google's at an advantage there, and Apple's going to have to catch up.
Look at Siri, Andy. I mean, we spoke about this before. Siri is a Pixar character come to life on your iOS device. But Google now has already got localized search. Half the stuff that Siri goes to the internet for, it does not need to go to the internet for. It should be able to do that locally, and that would increase perceptive speed. And Google now is even doing predictive answers where I don't have to ask a question. It's already providing me with this. And I don't know how equipped Apple is to push that kind of technology as fast as Google is.
Yeah.
Another thing to keep in mind with iCloud and why I said, well, I don't care that much, it's good enough, is for the stuff that I would care more about and where I think iCloud has significant problems, as does Apple, is they don't understand that a lot of what I do online is sharing stuff with other people. So like documents in the cloud where you can have your Pages files available to you and Pages on different Macs and iOS devices that you own, you know, whatever, big deal. I wouldn't consider using that because I need multiple people to get at my files all the time. So I'm, you know, going to be in Dropbox or some service that acknowledges sharing. And Google, and their services, a lot of it is all about people working together in groups, people hanging out for cooking lessons. I don't think we're ever going to see, you know, people hanging out for cooking lessons in iCloud, because Apple's all about, for some reason, their products really are all about one person, one device, one set of data. And that's a big frustration that they're definitely going to need to figure out how to get over, in addition to some of the more sort of, you know, low level hardware and software stuff with their cloud.
Hmm. Now, is this a problem that they can solve by writing checks and buying the right companies? There's a blog post that was linked to by Patrick Gibson, who's making the case that Apple should buy Twitter. Twitter's in that sort of vulnerable mode where they could be much like the short panted one from AC/DC. Once the right amount of silver gold is put in the pot, they could decide they no longer want to be an IPO, that they actually want to be bought out and become part of the Apple family. But
if Apple has the money, yes. You know, if money can solve this problem, Apple's got the cash. But I think it's really a philosophical approach that Apple needs to get over in their everyday just approach to everything.
It's nuance.
It seems as though part of it is Google is a company that is culturally about sharing muchly personal information that you wish that they weren't sharing with advertising partners. But it is true, Tanya, that it seems like part of their DNA is why wouldn't you want this information to be shared with as many people as possible? Why wouldn't you want this document to be indexed and linked to from other people? Whereas Apple's philosophy is sandboxing, saying we're going to protect you, we're going to control the experience, it's going to be like Disneyland where we're going to make sure you have a good experience, and we're going to do that so aggressively, we're going to make it impossible for you to try to have a bad experience. And so it seems as though they just, even if they bought the right company, they would quickly, after being in the same air conditioning as Apple for the past 10 or 15 years, they would also be saying, iWeb version 5, Now we're using our own version of a syndication feed that doesn't interact with anything, but it's better. You're welcome, the web.
Right. I think if you look at Apple and its culture, and one reason they can't do social is because basically they're an antisocial company. And so, I mean, they are.
And it comes back to AC/DC as usual.
AC/DC. But they are. I mean, they're very internalized. They look inward all the time. They know best. So even if they did acquire a company like Twitter, you know that they'd put the Apple screws to it. And then it becomes not so social anymore. But it becomes, we believe this is the box that you should live in when you're doing social networking. Even though we haven't had any success doing it prior to this, we think this is the way it should be done. So yes, it would be great if they had that, the engineers and the technology. But again, I just think there's something about that culture where they don't get it. They don't want to open up. They want to close things down, make sure they have control of it. And in a lot of cases, that's helpful to the users. But for these sorts of things, I don't think it is. It's one of those things where Apple really needs to sort of, you know, take a drink, settle down a little bit, and let things go for a while.
A sandbox is not a sandbox if it only allows one kid inside to play it with it at a time.
Right.
They did hire the Amazon server guy, and there's an argument, you know, they could theoretically want to buy Nuance because they're relying on Nuance technology for a lot of Siri, or maybe Bertrand Serlet's new cloud startup would one day be an acquisition target for Apple. But billions of dollars can't buy you time, and a lot of other companies have a huge lead on them. And like you all said, you can't buy you culture. So Apple, I think at some point they're going to have to do a Microsoft and just decide they're going to go all in on server infrastructure and come up with something as compelling as Amazon or Google or Facebook is fielding.
We have some competing theories from Apple Insider and CNET about the future of the new iMac. One is saying that it's going to be delayed until early 2013 because of a manufacturing issue. I believe CNET is saying, no, we will see them very, very soon. However, they'll be in slight, they're claiming that they believe that's going to be in short supply internationally. I know that I've been getting a lot of questions from people about it, or why can't I walk into a store and get it right now? It does point out that Apple is kind of unique amongst all of the high level hardware manufacturers, that they are almost always experimenting with a new process for assembling and manufacturing something with every generation of product. Every year they come out with something, which is the reason why it's usually why when Apple comes up with a radical new manufacturing process or a radically new design, such as this new iMac, which is designed to be super thin, so thin that it's too thin even for an SD card slot on the side of it. When there's something this radical, that's why I always caution people to don't order one of the first units of these off the boat. Wait about 30 days until there's several hundred thousand copies of this in play at once. And that's when they're going to start refining their processes, identifying places where, okay, this works just fine, but this, if we were to make this adjustment, then we will be able to assemble them a little bit better. This problem that is cropping up in a very, very small handful of machines will no longer come up at all. So that's just a free piece of advice. But it does give us some extra time to think about, like, our own futures with the Mac. That I gotta have a confession that I spent some time with Intel last week, showing me a whole bunch of different machines, and I saw at least two. They look really good. Two Windows 8 machines, and I'll be honest with you, they look real good. I've temporarily forgot my marriage vows to the Mac OS while I was in this cocktail lounge just looking at this wonderful, wonderful device. It was a Samsung convertible tablet where follow me here. It was a Windows 8 multi-touch tablet, about as thin as an iPad 4, about as light as an iPad 4. It was widescreen instead of the iPad's aspect ratio. But in all respects, when you hold on to it, it is a regular iPad-like device. It clicks into a really hard dock that gives you a full laptop experience with a working hinge and everything. This isn't like the smart covers you might have seen on Surface RT, where it's this really thin, plasticky sort of thing. It types very nicely, but it was designed to be really thin and light. This is really something almost identical to a MacBook Air, just a little bit thicker, but otherwise identical to a MacBook Air. The two clinchers here, when you compare it to an 11-inch MacBook Air, which costs $1,000, the tablet portion of it costs $5.99. The keyboard station costs about another $130. So already it's way, way underneath. Thirdly, it runs all desktop apps as well as a nicely optimized multi-touch operating system. But the kicker is that whereas the 11-inch MacBook Air runs for about 6 hours, I found about 5 hours on battery, this will run at least 10. And that's when I start thinking to myself, I don't want this. I still want a Mac, but this is probably the first time I've ever thought that if in 2013, 2014, there's a lot of good software available for the modern version of Windows 8, you know, the multi-touch operating system, and I've got $1,000 in my pocket that I thought I was going to spend on an iPad 5, I could see myself maybe getting swayed by this thing solely because this is exactly how I outfit my iPad for travel use, a separate tablet for like really cool fun and games, and then I drop it into a keyboard dock for full keyboard style keyboarding experience. And there are times when I wish it could run desktop apps, but I do without them because I'm traveling for a week. So it kind of invites a little bit of thought. I mean, I don't necessarily think that anything's better than the Mac right now, but this group of people here together, we have more than a half a century of full-on Mac OS use between us, where that's been our primary computer, in most cases our sole computer. What would it take for you to ever switch away from the Mac? I'm not necessarily saying switch to Windows 8 or switch to anything else. I'm saying, is there anything, any other kind of device or any kind of operating system or any kind of feature set or any kind of price set that would make you think, you know, I had this pile of money I was going to spend on a new Mac. I think I'm going to spend it on this thing instead. And Tanya, why don't you start off with the...
Well, sure.
We don't want to talk about this because it's too creepy to contemplate that we're staring at something that's not an Apple.
Back in the day, I used the Apple IIs, and I used DOS, and I even learned some Unix, and I used early versions of Windows and all this stuff. And at some point, long ago, I said, if I learn any of these other stuff any better, I'm going to have to help people use that. And the actual operating system that I enjoy using is the Mac. So I'm going to kind of ignore this other stuff mostly, so I will never get good enough at it that I can actually answer a sensible question about it. So that way people just ask me about the Mac. And so for me, I came to enjoy the consistent vocabulary that we have when we talk about the Mac's interface. Apple has whole style guides, as does Microsoft, but the consistent vocabulary, the consistent user interface, the pride that the entire Mac community and Apple takes in the design. And I learned a lot about using the Mac. And of course, in my professional life, I edit books about using the Mac and iOS. So I actually know quite a lot about it. So for me to switch, I think that the people in my broader community, my friends who are developers, my family, my colleagues, they'd have to be thinking about switching too. Because if I was going to switch, it would be a huge effort because I have to learn all this new stuff. And I might not have time to learn all that new stuff. So in order, basically the Mac would have to suck. It would have to suck so much more than whatever I was switching to. It would just have to be like just unacceptable. So, I'm in my mid-40s and I've been doing this for a long time. And I think it's cool that other people use other machines. And I think it's cool that there are other machines that make Apple work hard to keep their stuff good. But I think it would take something really compelling to make me switch operating systems. And, if someone's recording, I know this is recorded, but in 10 years, if someone pulls this clip out and says, look at you now, Tanya, you're on this totally different operating system, we'll all have a laugh then. But right now, it feels improbable. I'm too entrenched.
So it'll take the National Guard and a brick of C4 to get you to get you out of the spaceship.
Yeah, at gunpoint, I'm sure I could switch.
How about you guys? I mean, is there part of it is that I guess part of it is just the problem of familiarity that I keep expecting the next version of Mac OS to be as revolutionary and revelatory as some other steps I've seen forward. I mean, unfortunately, Apple has the success of getting things right early on that they haven't felt a need to really say, well, why don't we just toss out this and start something brand new? They can do these simple incremental things all wrapped around the exact same interface. Meanwhile, I guess the best example is that it's sort of like when I've had the same watch for 3 or 4 years. I did not even look at what other watch companies were doing. And then when I came back to when this finally broke and I said, great, I haven't looked at digital watches in 4 or 5 years. I bet they've done really exciting and wonderful things. And I was disappointed because, well, it was the same watches I'd ever seen. So there's really no reason for me to go back to this model that I had before. So, I mean, is it familiarity? I mean, but let's get back to the original question. Chris, is there anything that could get you to switch away from using the Mac as your primary machine? I will include iOS. If there ever became, let's say, let's say that Apple did a little bit more of a professional iPad and made it a little bit easier to make it like a daily use machine, like, or any other operating system. Do you feel like Zoe, you're Mac guy forever?
Let me anger yet another group of people, and that would be audiophiles. I care more about music than I care about sound. So that's the way I look at my technology as well. If my tools are providing me with the functionality I need to do the things I really want to do, which is write or create music or play games or something else, I'm happy. And so as much as I look at devices and think, well, this is a good price, or this is really powerful, or it's got a better processor, it's got this, it's got that, from a tactical perspective, I think that's all fine, but that's not really what I care about. To me, that's like listening to sound instead of music. What I want is a device that allows me to get my work done or get my play done as efficiently and as enjoyably as possible. Now, currently, that's the Mac. Now, I completely agree with Tanya in terms of, oh, you mean I have to learn a new thing to do this? What a new device would have to present me is some way that I can have as much fun or more fun doing this thing and getting it done efficiently instead of having to learn a different way and end up with the same result. So ideally, I'd like this to be results driven. Can I get a better result from this piece of technology? Do I have to suffer a lot to get there? No. All right, maybe that's tempting. And I think on the iOS, we're starting to see some of that. There are reasons I go to the iOS instead of a Mac to do things, but I won't embrace the iOS entirely because they're certain things that my Mac does a whole lot better than an iOS device. So staying away just from the geek enjoyment of things, it's going to be tough unless somebody can present me with something that is going to produce a better result for me.
Mm. Renee, how about you?
The way our network works is that we have a site for iOS, which I take care of. We also have an Android site, a BlackBerry site, a Windows site. And almost always once a year, we each take a week and we swap devices and try out all the competing stuff for a week. So I get a little taste of the other stuff that's out there. And I'm not, I'm certainly not opposed to switching. I started off with an Apple II. I went DOS. I went to an Amiga for a while. I went back to Mac. I went to Windows machines. But the difference now is that it's not so much of a single device play, but there's such an ecosystem investment. And I have an iPhone, an iPad, an Apple TV, a Mac. I have all the apps. And ripping and replacing becomes then a much more expensive, time-consuming, and involved ordeal. It's not the same as when I ditched a Vista laptop at work for a MacBook Pro. I would have to figure out a way to, you know, get my media onto the devices, get that stuff onto my television. What would I need to have a tablet? What would I need to have a computer? All just working together. What would fill the iCloud void? What would fill the AirPlay void? So it becomes a much more complicated question. And I think, like Tanya, Apple would have to descend to such a pit of darkness and insanity that all of that became better than living with what I have today to get me to actually get my lazy ass off the couch enough to do it.
So Colonel Kurtz would absolutely have to go upriver.
Yes.
and seat himself as the new CEO. In order for that to happen.
Yeah, absolutely. At this stage, absolutely.
I think it's an odd question because I think that a lot of what I do is becoming just independent of device completely, where so long as I have a system that can run a good version of Microsoft Word, so long as it can allow me to share and access files, so long as it can cover 8 core critical features, and usually that involves one of 6 apps that are available for just about every operating system. I feel as though it's not as big a deal for me to switch. It would not necessarily be as big a deal for me to switch platforms. And so it's sort of like what I was going through over the summer with the Samsung Galaxy S3, where I felt as though Android had matured to such a degree where it wasn't as good as iOS, but it was close enough that, again, getting back on that big two-balance scale, iOS is still better. But then when you put on, yes, but Apple will not build a device with a large screen. Oh, that is nice. Apple won't build a device with this kind of video camera. Oh, that is nice. It sort of balances each other out. And I think that if Apple were to ever sort of lose sight of who's out there buying computers these days and what they're using them for, it could be a day where macOS still wins every single usability and customer satisfaction index. But the damn fact is that people want a tablet that runs a desktop powerful operating system, and Apple still doesn't believe that that's a good thing for them to do. So I don't know. I mean, I reassure, there are people who get upset every time I write something positive about something that doesn't have an Apple logo on it. I understand that fear, because I see that fear every time I look in the mirror and shave every morning, or I'll be honest, 3 times at most out of every week. at the same time, you don't want to keep you want to make sure that you keep voting from the heart, from the head, and not from the heart. I would hate to have to be one of these people. Remember the dark ages in the late 90s when, okay, I need a new computer. I guess I'll buy a Performa 821 CD. Why? Because it's an Apple. But this other Microsoft, this other Windows machine, I know, but I can't buy a Windows machine. Why not? Because it would be less expensive, more reliable, and I could run more software on it. That's why I can't buy a Windows machine. I just don't want to be one of those people ever again. I want to make sure that I can always be arrogant about my choice of an Apple product. I worry that if Apple continues to make their $2,500 laptops that don't have an Ethernet port, they might like lose the common man, the Joe, the Jane six pack, the Johnny lunchbox, as the GOP campaign commercials so very badly portrayed them in. Larry, you're trying to portray a construction worker. Could you please take off the monocle? Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to. Anyway,
but maybe this does come back to Tanya's point about familiarity, where I'm fine on a Windows machine until I go off-road, and at which point I have no idea what's happened. And I have plenty of experience with a Mac, so if I go off-road there and something terrible happens, if I have a kernel panic or something crashes or this is a little funky, I know what to do with it. Once I get on a Windows machine and that kind of thing happens, you know, I go look at the tech sites and they say reinstall Windows, which seems like a poor solution.
Who have bought a new Windows machine because it was too hard to fix the old one.
Yeah.
Right? They're like, no, I'm not going to reinstall Windows. I'm just go buy a whole new machine. This one's going out the window. but another thing to consider, because, you know, we're all getting a little older, but for instance, my son Tristan, he doesn't really have things on his computer per se. His music, Spotify. His homework documents, all that kind of stuff, Google Docs. His, stuff. I don't even know if we back up his computer. We probably do, but there's no urgent need to. So for him, he actually doesn't care too much which computer he uses, which is good because he has to do homework like all the time everywhere. So he uses whatever computer is available. But I wonder if for, sort of this younger generation coming up, if they actually will care less, because it won't matter. What they're interacting with is really just in a web browser and some kind of app that's talking to online.
So all the conspiracy theorists who worry about the UN trying to impose a one world government, you think that their first beachhead is going to be operating systems and hardware platforms?
Oh, sure. And stealing all your passwords and bank account information by keylogging what you do on them. Yeah.
But will Facebook welcome the competition on that?
I think they have a patent.
Okay, let's take another break. After the break, we're going to be coming back for our picks of the week. But before that, we have another wonderful message from our friend Leo Laporte, who wants to make your life better through the magic of Audible audiobooks. Leo?
Excuse me, one more word, if you don't mind, in your ear about audible.com. And Andy, when you come back, you can give us your Audible pick since I'm not here right now. But I got to tell you, I should show you my mini. Because I loaded it up. 14 and a half hour plane flight to Australia. You better believe I have put a ton of stuff on here. One of them is, I think, one you recommended, Andy, the Pete Townsend biography or autobiography, Who Am I? I've got, among others, from Joe Walton. These are mostly recommendations from our hosts. The End of Money. Look at, what is this, 11 books? That's how scared I am of this 14 and a half hour plane ride. There's no way I could. But these are all great books that I've been dying to read. I can't wait to read. And I read Kill Decision, so I'm going to take that off the list. And I just finished Cloud Atlas, and now I'm ready to see the movie. I got to tell you, Audible is fantastic. If you haven't yet tried Audible.com, I do not know what's keeping you, but I urge you to give it a shot. 100,000 plus books. It's the best bookstore in the world, and they're all audiobooks. You're right, John Hodgman is missing Yoho Jones, but that's because I've already read all the John Hodgman's books. Just such great stuff. It got me back into books. I have to be honest. I just didn't have time. You know, I got busy. We had the kids. I was, you know, working hard at Tech TV. I just didn't have time to read. But in a way, the commute when we moved up here to Petaluma was the blessing, it turned everything around, because spending a couple of 3 hours a day in the car means I had 2 or 3 hours a day to listen to audiobooks. And that was it, man. Since then, I've read over 300 books, or listened to over 300 books on audible.com. And the neat thing is, with the Audible app, all those books are still available to me. Let me show you the Audible app. It's available for Windows Phone, for iPhone. Here it is on Android. Let me pull it up on my Android device. And I listen on my Sonos. I have it playing throughout the house. So this is the Audible app, which is a great way to keep track of everything you've got. These are all the books. By the way, you notice these are much of the same books that I had on my iPad. I also have on my Android phone because I'm so paranoid. Well, what if I lose the iPad so I can listen on here? And WhisperSync is great because when I stop listening on one device and pick it up on another, it will immediately jump to that position on the other device, which is very, very handy. Audible is just fantastic. I want you to give it a try. Here's the deal. All you have to do is go to 324 books in my Audible library. So I stand corrected. So you just load the library and everything. Oh, I got to get Who Am I on there. Download that. Everything that you've ever listened to or ever bought, even if you never listened to it, is available on this app. To me, it suddenly makes a 14 and a half hour plane ride something I'm looking forward to. I'm going to get some time to listen to, like, oh, here's another one I got to download. The Girl Who Kicked the Hornet's Nest. I only listened to the first of the Millennium Trilogy. I got to listen to that too. Let's download that right now. I got The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. Oh, man. It's just fantastic. This is a good one. Christopher Buckley's book about his father, William F. Buckley, Losing Mom and Pup. That was a great book. Loved that. It's kind of fun to go back. The Life and Works of Chopin. I don't even remember listening to that. That was Homer Simpson. You can ignore that. Did you hear that? Seabiscuit, what a great book that was. And I've got Secretariat, too. I know that was one Andy really liked. Anyway, audible.com/MacBreak. You could choose your first book free. You'll be signing up for that gold account, a book a month. Your first month's free. Your first credit is free. Cancel at any time. Pay nothing but that credit. That book is yours to keep forever and ever. And I got another book for you absolutely free. I'm in the middle of this one. I love it. It's a novella. Brian Sanderson's Legion. This one is so, you don't need a credit card, you don't need a trial offer, you don't even, if you're a member, you can get it for free. It's audible.com/Sanderson, S-A-N-D-E-R-S-O-N, Brandon Sanderson's Legion, absolutely free. So that's two free books from audible.com. We love them so much. I would do ads for them anytime, even if they didn't pay me. They're so great. And if you're not a member, you got to try it. Audible.com/MacBreak. Andy, you got a pick? You got something you like?
Yes, I do, but I'm going to be reserving it for next week since you were did so eloquent job recommending your own pick of the week. And also, there are only 24 hours in the day, Leo, and that but if I spend exactly 8 minutes looking at my audiobook list and then picking one to pick, then that's time that's well invested in more on-air promotions. Although what you just witnessed there, though, everybody, that's exactly the way that it goes with the. Your audiobook collection is exactly like your bookshelf, where you can't just you think that you're just going to tell us, oh, I got these shelves at IKEA, but you know, if you go down to the hardware store and replace the fittings, and oh, have I ever shown you this P.G. Woodhouse anthology I got? It's all of the golf store, and you just keep talking about the books you liked, and it's hard to get off of it. But let's get off of it and start talking about our picks of the week, and we're going to start with you, Renee. What is your pick?
My pick of the week is Kaleidoscope 2. Kaleidoscope was originally made by Sofa, and then they were bought out by Facebook. So Kaleidoscope was sold to Black Pixel. And Black Pixel is an interesting company. They make a lot of the best apps that you're not actually aware that they make. They're third party. They do a lot of contract work. But they started to kind of take care of these apps, and they bought Kaleidoscope, and they bought NetNewsWire. And Kaleidoscope 2 is the first Black Pixel version to come out of the gate, and they're doing a public beta with it. So you can download a free 15-day trial. If you do, you qualify for 50% off pricing. It'll be in the Mac App Store. You'll be able to buy it from Black Pixel. They'll have a variety of sales up when it goes live. But if you're not familiar with Kaleidoscope, it's a great tool. It's for people who want to compare two different things, two different images, two different text files, two different programming files. And it'll just go through and run a diff and show you what the differences are between the two pictures, between the two documents, between the two lines of code. And it's got a very elegant interface. It's been redesigned from the ground up. They've had some incredibly talented designers and developers working on it. I'm enjoying it quite a bit. So if it's not for everybody, but it's for people who really do care about getting that final version to contain every bit and pixel that you want to be in it.
I probably need that for myself. Every time I get a new MacBook, I just copy the old documents folder onto it. And so if there's like novel sketches and things I've been working on for like a long time, I might have like 9 instances starting with like the first notes about how about a book about pirates? And then here's and that 11 different versions of chapter one. And so I could probably benefit very much from Kaleidoscope 2. Excellent pick. Tanya, what is your pick?
Well, Andy, my pick is a little bit of explanation, which is you may recall when you asked me if I could be on MacBreak Weekly, I said yes, and in fact it fits in my schedule so well because my schedule is very light this week. But the reason my schedule is light this week is because I've just spent the past, I don't know, month basically pumping out ebooks for Take Control Books, and really all I've been doing is editing and producing ebooks very tightly. So my pick, if you will, is just something I've been working on a lot, which is a new ebook. I've got it on my iPad here, and I'll try to center it, but I'll also tell you what it's called. It's called Take Control of Mail on the iPad, iPhone, and iPod Touch. It's written by Joe Kissel, who writes for Macworld and other popular publications. So a lot of people have probably read his work. And he just walks you right through exactly how to set up mail on your iOS device, how to make it work with iCloud Mail, how to make it work with Gmail, all kinds of great stuff. And I think it's a great read. It certainly helped me a lot. It's being very popular with our readers. You can pick it up for $10 on the Take Control site. And I think it's a pretty cool book.
Well, it must be pretty cool because it is a Take Control book. I sometimes refer to Take Control as my offsite deep understanding of things. Last time I had explained something in detail about a certain Mac app, as might have been like 8 months previously. And if I just buy a simple, effective, and inexpensive Take Control book, I will remember everything that I thought I remembered knowing from the previous thing. And I suddenly become smart again on that topic.
Absolutely. Chris, what do you have for us? The reason I edit all the books is because otherwise I wouldn't be able to use my Mac.
Exactly. You get a free copy with every 8 week editorial cycle. Not a very good compensation plan. Chris, what do you have for us?
Well, you know, we talk an awful lot about the kind of cool things that we can do with our computers and with iOS devices, and things that used to be difficult and expensive are now easy and quite affordable. And one of the things that I do in my off time is I'm a musician. I'm a piano player, but I do other kinds of musical work as well. And there is an application out for iOS called the DM1, which is DM1, the drum machine. It's $7. And what it offers you is a virtual drum machine that way back in the day we used to pay a lot of money for. So people who know about this stuff, if you think about the TR-707, TR-909, these are all Korg beatboxes that have been adopted in the last 10 years or so by people who are doing hip-hop and that kind of thing. If you were buying one of these vintage boxes, it would cost you a lot of money. And even buying hardware drum boxes are not cheap. And now for $7, you can get a really wonderful drum machine emulation. So they've got all those samples in there from the old days, plus they have new ones, plus you can create your own samples. So not only do they have grid recording, but they also have pads that you can tap on and you can play live if you want. There's a mixer on there, so you can do that. You can add effects to things. You can create songs just as you could in the old days, having to strain together patterns of beats, which honestly is a pain in the neck. But if you sort of like that old school way of creating beats and putting together compositions, it's really cool. So this is just one example of this kind of thing where you can do for, you know, under $10, have this very, very powerful musical technology at your disposal. We have synthesizer modules that do the same thing that, again, $10 to $20, you're getting an old Moog synthesizer for nothing, whereas you would pay, you know, thousands of dollars for these things. So this is a great interface, good sounds, cheap at $7. If you are at all interested in creating little rhythm backgrounds to go with the other kind of stuff that you're doing elsewhere, I heartily recommend it. It's a great app. Plus, you can export your work and then take it into anything you like. You can put it in GarageBand if you want. You can put it into Logic or Performer or Cubase or one other music application you like. Check it out. If you're a musician or a wannabe musician, you should give it a try.
Sounds like a fun thing to play with. And at $7, a lot of people are going to be having bar mitzvah, going to be having Hanukkah and or Christmas gift money to spend, or winter tree solstice money to spend in the form of iTunes gift cards. Kind of a cool thing to play with. My pick of the week is not necessarily something that came out recently, but it's something that I have recently rediscovered and found completely indispensable. This is not my pick of the week. This is a very, very early Griffin Technology iPad stand, and it's the aluminum murder death weapon that I actually keep right here next to my chair at the podcast studio to hold the machine that I use for squirrel pictures and stuff like that. But iPad stand technology has made incredible leaps forward, and the exact same work being done by that device is now being done for me on a daily basis by this device. This is the Ethic Wing Stand. Yes, it is that simple, that small, but so much nicer. What you're seeing here is in its portable mode. It's actually two halves that you can split apart. There you go. They click together for storage. But as I'm sure you can kind of figure out, you on the profile like that, you just put one next to the other, and then you can just simply hang your iPad mini or your full-sized iPad or your Kindle or any other device. Ideally, you would not be holding it all in one hand, but I think you get what I'm talking about here. The fact that they're two separate elements means that it'll work with small devices, it'll work with large tablets, it'll work with little phones. And the reason why it's becoming so critical for me is that, as I said, I do use my iPad just as my normal, like, outside-of-the-house computer, whether I'm going to be in a hotel room for a week or just going to be in a coffee shop near my house for 2 or 3 hours. And I keep finding that I'm using these 9-inch tablets sort of like as a second productivity screen as a second window for whatever I'm doing on the iPad, you know, because the iPad is just a one window interface. I can keep a web browser on the iPad mini. I can keep like a Netflix app or a music app. And by having this tiny, tiny little wing stand next to it there, man, it's a very, very slick way to do business. And because it's so flexible, I mean, it's tiny, so it'll fit in any pocket in the bag that I keep my iPad in. It's $15. I mean, and for that amount of money, I've actually gone and bought like 3 or 4 more online. You can get them through Amazon. And it's quickly become one of my favoriteest things in the entire world. That's it for Mac Break for this week. Before we close the window, we'd like to once again offer thanks and remunerations to our guest this week. Of course, Renee is not our guest. He's our co-host on a weekly basis. Always great to have a chance to talk to you each and every week, Renee. Renee can be found on iMore, where he is essentially the, can I call you czar of pretty much everything news and rumor related?
Or is you can call me inaccurate? Anything you want, Andy. Absolutely.
Buttercup.
Perfect.
next, there you go. We have that on tape. And so for the next week, we're going to have your lower third be Buttercup of iMore.com. Chris Breen, I think if I were to give you a name from The Princess Bride, it would probably be the Dread Pirate Roberts, because I think that you would know your way around a fencing foil. I just get that. You've got the hair of a buccaneer. Let's just say that.
Well, Andy, unfortunately, I've never had to demonstrate that particular skill at you, but you're correct. I'm devilish with a ballpoint pen, so don't anger me.
And of course, you're senior editor of Macworld. Where else can we direct you when people want to see evidence of everything that makes the Chris Breen experience such a your go-to resort for your weddings, your anniversary parties, your bowling parties, and your retirement events?
Right. I check out lynda.com. I'm doing lots of work for them. I'm doing a lot of courses for them, and they do excellent work, and the stuff I do for them is not bad.
Excellent. Tanya Angst from Tidbits Publishing. You already showed us your latest wonderful ebook. Anything else you'd like to mention?
Those who are doing NaNoWriMo or who just want to write a lot, we have a 50% off sale right now on two books that'll help you write better. Book about text expander for typing short things to expand into long, long things. And a book about Scrivener, which is a really awesome tool for putting together complex plots. So that's 50% off, and you can find that on the Take Control homepage. Not much else except it was fun to be on the show.
Excellent. Hope everybody has a great Thanksgiving. And just because you got a 4-day weekend doesn't mean you shouldn't put in a full day on Thursday. Now get back to work. Mac Break is over. I'm checking.